You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this week, and holy cow, there's a lot. Today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
We're not going to leave with my story about restaurants, right?
Yeah, no, you know, Don, I was going to, and then I thought, you know, there might be some other things that
just might
may have made bigger headlines. You know, I frankly, Don, I wish we were at a place where we could start with that. However,
me too.
Right. But we really do have to talk about the pandemic, but in particular, really hospitals and frankly, being in a state of crisis. Melissa, in fact, you did a special on this last night on Idaho Reports. Can you first, let's go to North Idaho and what's happening up there, because classrooms are now being used to house patients?
Not quite yet, Gemma, but okay. They are being set up, in anticipation of needing that overflow space. And when Kootenai Health does need to move patients to these converted classroom spaces, it's going to trigger the internal process to officially ask the state to declare crisis standards of care, which is, again, the systemic kind of it's a framework to help hospitals figure out how to ration care in the most ethical way possible. And so this isn't hyperbole. This is a very dire situation. Last night, we had Dr. Robert Scoggins from Kootenai Health join us, as well as other healthcare professionals from around the state. And he said this is essentially a field hospital that they're setting up within the hospital. And in his career, he has never seen anything or had to do anything like this before. They are already at a point in North Idaho where they cannot accept transfers from the small rural critical access hospitals in the area. So if you're in St. Mary's, for example, and you have a heart attack, you may not be able to get a bed right away in Coeur d'Alene. You may not be able to get treatment right away. They might have to just do the best they can in your community while they wait for space to open up. And this is starting to happen all over the state. It's a very serious situation.
And Melissa, here in the Treasure Valley, you know, we're not at the point where Kootenai is. However, some of our hospitals are over capacity.
Right. And I know that, you know, you've done such a fantastic job with keeping listeners in the loop about the situation here in Treasure Valley. You know, around the state, these hospitals are in various states of at least critical care, but Kootenai in Coeur d'Alene is the closest to asking the state officially to declare those crisis standards of care. They're at a point where they can't find other places to transfer their patients to because Spokane is full. They're having to move patients as far away as Seattle and Portland. And if you've been following the news from our neighboring states, they're in just as bad, if not worse, a situation than we are. And so this is extremely serious in Kootenai. And I know that hospital leaders in Treasure Valley are looking at what's happening in Coeur d'Alene and what's happening to the west in Oregon, and are very concerned that we're going to hit that point here in Boise and Nampa in the next few weeks as well.
Melissa, I'm curious if any of these medical experts who were on your program last night, the sense of fatigue, frustration that they must be feeling. I mean, did that conversation come up at all? Because I think at least when we are speaking with medical experts on our program, it's so much about how this was preventable.
That absolutely came up, just how burned out all of these healthcare workers are, because as you know, statewide, they're facing a staffing shortage. And, you know, up in Coeur d'Alene, they never got to zero COVID patients throughout this entire pandemic, from the very beginning when they got their first patient, they've always had at least one COVID patient in ICU. And so they never really got a break, and they have this flood. I just checked their dashboard. They have 94 COVID patients hospitalized in Coeur d'Alene just at their facility right now. And that doesn't count the patients that they've transferred out to other facilities. So they are exhausted. They're frustrated that there's still so much denial about how serious the pandemic is in their community. They're still frustrated about the amount of misinformation. Kootenai Health doesn't have a COVID vaccine mandate for its staff. They never have. Mm. And there are still people in their community who are attributing the staffing shortage to vaccine mandates. So that's just not the case. They've had a staffing shortage this entire time without a mandate. And so it's this, the shifting goalposts, right, that we're seeing.
Right.
The people who originally said the pandemic isn't real and it's being blown out of proportion and people aren't actually dying from this. And well, they're dying, but not that many, or they had underlying conditions. Now that the hospitals are over capacity and we're dealing with a staffing shortage, regardless of whether or not the hospital in question has a vaccine mandate with that deadline coming up, the goalposts just continue to shift. And well, yeah, we have a hospital crisis right now, but it's the hospital's fault. This flood of misinformation combined with the sheer amount of work it takes to care for these critically ill COVID patients. And they're getting younger and younger and sicker, by the way. That mm-hmm. has its own mental toll on these healthcare professionals. And so all of that combined is just incredibly disheartening for the healthcare workers that I've spoken to, their bosses. And you can tell too, I don't want to say, these guys looked exhausted. They are tired, right.
Right.
And because they've been working so hard to save people's lives. And in some cases, Dr. Scoggins from Coeur d'Alene told me last night, they still, not all of them, believe that it's caused by COVID. And others, you've seen this around the country too, as right before they're being ventilated, they asked, how soon can I get vaccinated once I get out of here? And it's just a heartbreaking and avoidable situation.
Yeah. With that said, Scott, other news coming out of the West Ada School District this week, they officially went back into school yesterday, but not before the school board, definitely lots of heated debate going on in the school board, mandated masks. But let's be honest, when you mandate, you have to mandate.
Right. Yeah. And in the middle of all of this, with the hospital cases spiking and COVID cases spiking, the kids are going back to school. And one of the mitigation efforts that a lot of people believe in is requiring masks of students. So Boise School District voted earlier that they would require masks for everyone, regardless of vaccination status. And so the West Ada School Board took that up this week, and they invited Dr. Jim Souza and Dr. Kenny Bramwell from St. Luke's to come and tell them about the situation, where we're at, how bad it is, it's bad, and what their recommendations were. And they recommended that the school district start, and this is the largest school district in the state. This is 37,500 students, covering Meridian and Eagle. And their recommendation was to start the school, or to at least start with a mask mandate for everyone and see how it goes, just to try to quell and stem the surge of COVID cases. And so the school board took several hours of testimony from parents and teachers and staff members. And they came to the conclusion that we'll follow that recommendation of requiring masks for everyone, with one pretty big caveat that if you want to opt out, you can opt out, which really is not a requirement. So, and sure enough, the next day there were several thousand parents and students who lined up on the first day of opting out. They had about 3,700 or 3,800 students opt out. And the next day they had another 3,000 or so. So I think as of yesterday, there were 6,700 or 7,000, about a quarter mm-hmm. of the student population had officially opted out of the mask mandate. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. You know, we've seen other school districts locally, Caldwell School District, they started out and had an outbreak of COVID, and it you know, it requires quarantining and people staying home. And so they went back to a mask requirement for everybody. And we've seen this across the country in other districts throughout the country. So we'll see if there's enough kids, you know, it's unfortunate that we're in this mode of, well, let's see if it gets really bad. And then if it gets bad, we'll take measures rather than let's take measures to try to prevent something bad happening. So that's where we're at in West Ada. We'll see how it goes.
And here's what I find interesting about this, Scott, is that I think that any parent who has a school age child and who has gone through the last year and a half of you know, homeschool, some type of hybrid with virtual and in school, some kids being in school, I would hope that no matter where you stand on the issue of masks versus non-masks, is that we want our kids physically in school. We know that is what is best.
And really, that's what, you know, Dr. Souza was saying to the school board. It's like, look, we all want to be back in person. We recognize how important that is for students' mental health and their education. And the best way to do that is by wearing masks, is for everybody to wear masks. They can do it. It's possible. And unfortunately, if you have a significant number of students without masks, you're just going to run that risk of, okay, we're going to go back to remote, or we've got to quarantine and do hybrid or whatever, and we're not going to be in person. So it's just, it's a roll of the dice, and we're rolling the dice with this in-person teaching.
Well, we're rolling the dice with not just, you know, teachers' health, but with students' health, because let's be very clear, you can only be vaccinated if you're 12 years or older. So we're sending kids back. 25% of students in West Ada, you know, opting out of this mask mandate. School is going to be disrupted. As you mentioned, Scott, that's what happened in Caldwell. We have an example in our backyard that this has already happened.
Right. And, you know, there's the argument, you know, which I think is valid, that, look, kids are not getting as sick. They're not dying. I don't think we have a death of anyone under the age of 18 in Idaho. And so that's kind of a justification for doing it. But really, what the point that's being missed is that we are trying to stop the spread. And so if you've got 10,000, 15,000 kids en masse spreading it to other kids, that, you know, that's the definition of a pandemic, when you have out of control spread. And so it's not necessarily, oh, kids are going to start dropping dead, but you're going to have this spread to other people that are going to overwhelm the healthcare system.
Just to hop in on that real quick,
ahead,
Gemma, you know, we've been incredibly fortunate that we have not had any pediatric deaths. Death isn't the only adverse outcome.
Exactly.
When we're talking about this, there have been children who have been very, very sick there's one who was recently transferred to Salt Lake City. I believe she's 2 or 3 years old, and potentially looking at an organ transplant directly because of a very quickly advancing case of COVID-19. Last night, we discussed this on Idaho Reports, and the state is kind of nervously anticipating a further rise in pediatric cases. And so again, this isn't fear-mongering. It's just looking at what's happening in other states and looking at the reality of the situation, that hopefully we will continue to not have any pediatric deaths. That's the outcome we want, but also recognizing that that isn't the only adverse outcome here.
Yeah. As a mother, how about it would be good to not have any pediatric cases of this, but we have already crossed that line. With that said, Dawn, interesting data coming out when we talk about COVID vaccines and your zip code. And I must confess, I've already looked up my zip code, and I feel a little better.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel, building on some reporting that Melissa had done, I think Melissa and Margaret both got tagged in a tweet, and they both kind of did the same thing, which is to ask for vaccination numbers by zip code. We have had obviously statewide data, we've had countywide data, but especially here in the urban center, the metro area, people want to know, like, well, okay, you know, Ada County's got like, what, 10, 15 zips in it. How does it look a little closer to home? So Margaret got that data and then crunched the numbers against the newest population estimates that we have, which are from 2019, and was able to map statewide how that looks as far as percent that are vaccinated. So you can look at in the Treasure Valley, 83716, which is primarily east and southeast Boise, has the highest percentage in our area, 0.7% vaccinated. The West, the less we're having, vaccinated is
it? Don, you are cutting out. So let's take a quick break and then let's get Don reconnected and then talk a little bit more about that. Continuing our reporter roundtable with Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. Don, let's go back to what we were talking about before we had some audio issues, but about individual zip codes and how we can get into this database and find out really who's vaccinated, but kind of the percentages.
Yeah, so if you load up the map on BoiseDev.com, you can look up any zip code across the state. And it's interesting because 83716, which is primarily east and southeast Boise, is the most vaccinated zip code in our area at about 70%. And while it does tend to decrease in vaccination rates the further you go to the west, it's not super even. So it's not like this gradient that just fades across the valley. It's really interesting to look at each zip code, and you can kind of hover over yours. And so you can look at 83687, and it's about 35%. If you go out towards Ontario, 83660 is 26%. It's just really fascinating to kind of see this and look across the state and see how things are going. There are some counties or some zip codes, rather, 83677, which is like smack dab in the middle of the state. Their vaccination rate in that zip code is 7%. So it really does widely vary across the state. For so long, we've been looking at this statewide number, right? And we've had this kind of picture of, you know, about half of the eligible folks 12 plus have taken a vaccination. And you go, okay, well, that's half, but it's way more nuanced than that. I noticed this morning that Audrey Dutton at the Idaho Capital Sun took a similar approach and did kind of the zip code level data for vaccinations, but they did something one step further, which is a slider that showed the number of COVID cases since May. And you can kind of look back and forth, and boy, sure enough, those counties that are more vaccinated have fewer COVID cases, and the counties that have less vaccinations, as you can imagine, have more COVID cases. So this, you know, we love data here, and we do a lot with that. And it's really interesting to see this really more granular picture of what's happening and what's going on in each individual community.
What I thought was
interesting. I just want to pop in. I had requested this data, and I've been kind of poring over it last week and earlier this week. And there are a couple caveats with some of the outliers where they're either extremely low or extremely high vaccination rates. This is looking at population estimates or counts from 2019. And as you know, Don has done such a fantastic job reporting on the explosive. So we know, especially when there are extremely low population zip codes, Clayton, Idaho is a perfect example. I think there were like 18 people in that 2019 census. They have a vaccination rate right now of 500%.
Because, oh, there you go.
Yeah, because, you know, you can think that perhaps it's because the vaccination data is imperfect, or maybe, you know, it just takes a few families moving in to really change that population number in the past 2 years. And so the numbers that we have are imperfect, but what Margaret and Audrey both did with that information was give people, especially in high populated areas, a good idea of what their vaccination rates in their neighborhoods are.
Mm-hmm. And I think what stood out to me, especially with Audrey's information on the Idaho Capital Sun, is, as Don, as you mentioned, was when you look at COVID cases versus rate of vaccination, because That was, I think, very telling when you look at that, right? So that in particular stood out to me. With that said, I want to get to a big win for the Idaho Press Club and journalists in general. Scott and Melissa, you've both been a part of this. Scott, why don't I start with you, and let's kind of set up what happened here and how this even got to court.
So Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan had set up this education indoctrination task force trying to root out critical race theory and Marxism and socialism. And she set up a Google form for feedback from Idaho residents to give their stories and give their perspective and give feedback to the task force as they deliberated. And a couple of reporters, Audrey Dutton from Idaho Capital Sun, Hayat Nora Mina from the Idaho Statesman, and Blake Jones from Idaho Education, who's filed public records requests asking for the feedback form information. And the Lieutenant Governor's office said that they were going to redact the information. They were going to redact people's names, email addresses, and their comments, and charge the reporters $560 to get those documents, which essentially would be useless without the comments, without the names, and without the email addresses. So Audrey Dutton brought this to my attention. So I'm the chairman of the First Amendment Committee, succeeding Melissa Davlin as the chairperson of the Idaho Press Club. And when we took a look at it, we said, boy, this is really egregious. This is worthy of a lawsuit, that we should sue for this information. We tried to work with the Lieutenant Governor's office in requesting the information again. And at one point, the Lieutenant Governor's office said, okay, well, we'll give you the comments, but we won't give you the names and the email addresses. And this is an important point, which I'll bring up later, but essentially it led to a lawsuit. And this week, Judge Stephen Hippler, we retained Wendy Olson of Stoll mm-hmm. Reeves, former U.S. attorney, fantastic lawyer. She did a great job for us. Big shout out to Wendy Olson. And Judge Hippler this week ruled in our favor, and really in strong words. Not only does the Lieutenant Governor have to turn over these documents, but she also has to pay our attorney fees, and she was fined $750 as a civil penalty for violating the state's public records law. And Judge Hippler, in his ruling, said that she acted deliberately and in bad faith. Her attorney, Colton Boyles, had cited a number of state and federal laws that had absolutely no bearing on this case at all, showing that she was just being obstructive. And in his ruling, he said that McGeehan would stop at nothing, no matter how misguided, to shield public records from the public. And he said that fear-mongering has no place in the calculus. If public officials were required to disclose public records only to those, including media, they believe will support the government's actions, we will have shed the principles of our democracy and evolved into an autocratic state where criticism of public officials is not permitted. So it was very strongly worded ruling. And I hope that it's a lesson to other public officials that, you know, you can't just arbitrarily apply the law. And Lieutenant Governor McGeehan has cited that the media would bully or harass people who had filed their information, and that would have a chilling effect, which I suppose you could make that argument and pass a law. But the at the end of the day, there is no law that says you can exempt records because you're afraid of reporters harassing people. And in fact, that really is just a strange argument. You know, at her own indoctrination task force meeting yesterday, you had Kayla Dunn, Eric Gironda, Amy Nelson, Shiva Rajbhantari testifying. And when they testified before the task force, they had to give their names. And you could see reporters going up and talking to them afterwards, not harassing them and not doxing them. And so it's the same concept here. So fortunately, we won this case. Unfortunately, it took a lawsuit and it took months of time and effort and wasted resources in to get these documents, which easily could have and should have been released months ago.
Mm-hmm. And Melissa, the Lieutenant Governor's response to this?
Her response was basically to say the legislature should change the law. She disagrees with the ruling, which isn't a surprise, but she says that she doubled down on the idea that this is a gateway for media harassing people who reach out to their elected officials. I just want to say I had exempted myself from involvement in this particular lawsuit and had stepped down as First Amendment chairman because of my spouse's new job. But I do mm-hmm. want to say in general that the reason reporters look for records like this is to see who has influence with their elected officials. You know, is it truly everyday citizens and parents and teachers who are reaching out? Is it are students saying that we're concerned about this, or are they, you know, donors? Are they fellow lawmakers? Are they, people from out of state? There are legitimate news gathering reasons, and ethical journalists don't harass people. Reaching out to people for comment is not harassing them. And that's something that's very important to ethical reporters who have training in this arena.
Oh, 100%. I mean, how many times can we all talk about experiences that we've had when we've asked someone for comment? If they say no, that's no. And it's as simple as that. And also, I mean, Scott, when we talk about public records requests, I mean, and I know, you know, Betsy Russell has done a lot of this with the Idaho Press, is that public records are also for the public, but sometimes journalists can do what you were able to do with the Idaho Press Club, unfortunately having to bring a lawsuit, but it is so that the average citizen can understand what our government is doing.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because not only, you know, I've had this before where people say, hey, can you file a public records request on my behalf? And I, you know, just because I'm a journalist doesn't mean that I have special privileges to file.
Exactly.
Anybody can do so. And so, you know, this is our job. And so we do this as part of our job. And that's great. But it does pave the way. Not only does it allow us to do our job and communicate to the public what's going on, but it paves the way to make it easier for the public to make these requests. And it's a public records law. It's for any member of the public to file a request for these documents. And there is a long history of Idahoans filing their own public records requests to get information that perhaps journalists were not looking for. And so hopefully, again, my hope is that other public officials read this ruling, as well as the Ada County ruling that the Idaho Press Club won under Melissa's leadership last time, a couple of years ago, read those decisions and err on the side of providing information that is covered by the public records law.
We're going to take another
point out with the, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Melissa, go ahead.
I would just also point out, lest anyone could be tempted to accuse the press club of going after conservative politicians, the Ada County lawsuit that Scott brought up, we sued a majority Democratic Ada County commission. At the time, it was majority Democratic. Public records and government transparency is not a partisan issue to us. It is simply a matter of accountability and letting our readers and viewers know what's happening with their taxpayer dollars.
I think Absolutely. At Boise Dev, we complain about public records for agencies led by Democrats far more often than conservatives. So I think it cuts across ideology.
So just FYI on that. All right, let's take a break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our reporter roundtable, Scott McIntosh with Idaho Statesman, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and Don Day with Boise Dev. Melissa, I know at the top of the show we talked about West Ada's mask decision to mandate, but not really mandate. There are other school districts in the state. We do know that Boise School District mandated masks and truly mandated masks. But what do we know about any of the other school districts around the state?
We know that Moscow School District in North Idaho is starting out the year with mask mandates. Coeur d'Alene, on the other hand, we spoke a lot earlier in the show about Kootenai Health and how they're close to over, well, not close to over, they are close to crisis standards of care and are already overflowing, but their local schools are not requiring masks. And so if you look at the majority of the state, it is masks optional with very few exceptions. Some of the school boards, like we just saw in Caldwell, like Scott talked about earlier, are reserving the right to change that policy depending on how cases are going. And so, but most public school students in Idaho are not going to school at a place that mandates masks right now.
Scott, you wrote an opinion piece earlier this week, and I want to talk about this because there are people who are comparing health measures to Nazi Germany and to the Holocaust. Not only is this hurtful language, frankly, it's ignorant, Scott. I mean, I was downtown Boise Tuesday evening and saw people picketing outside of Kin Restaurant in downtown Boise with signage that basically called them Nazis because of their decision as a private company to require a vaccine or a negative COVID test to dine at their restaurant.
Right. And we've seen this really from the beginning, since the beginning of the pandemic with the government shutdown and the health mandates. We've seen these comparisons to the Holocaust. And then in recent days, we've seen Nampa City Council member Darryl Bruner made a comparison to racial segregation of the 50s and 60s, a bizarre comparison. Fellow city council member Sandy Levi, she said she was reminded of the Star of David when she saw the caution tape trying to social distance people in the council chambers. And then the Kin restaurant where people calling them Nazis. And, you know, I think if you think that a restaurant refusing service to unvaccinated people in order to keep its customers safe and its business open, we're trying to keep businesses open with these vaccination requirements. And if you compare those efforts to the Holocaust, you clearly don't understand what the Holocaust was or who the Nazis were or what they did. And, you know, not only is it ignorant, like you said, it's dangerous because it shows that we did not learn the lessons that we were supposed to learn from the Holocaust and from racial segregation. If you think what we're going through right now is, you know, just like racial segregation, boy, you really don't understand what racial segregation was all about and mm-hmm. how it happened. And for city council members, because, you know, a lot of the consequences or why racial segregation came about was because of government decisions from city councils and county commissions and state legislators. And so for a city council member to have a gross misunderstanding of what racial segregation was and how it happened, you know, is frankly dangerous and could be harmful. Same thing with the Holocaust. If you don't understand the lessons that we were supposed to learn from the Holocaust, that puts us in a really bad place because, again, if those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And so, you know, again, I think it's just really important to speak out anytime you hear somebody talk like that, to point out how misguided and dangerous that kind of language mm-hmm. is.
And I think, Scott, in particular, when you talk about the killing of 6 million people, and you compare it to you not being able to dine in a restaurant. Let's be very clear. You can dine at this particular restaurant. You have to have a negative COVID test. You can dine. You don't have to get vaccinated to dine there. That is not right. The same as being taken from your home, taken from everything that you know, put into a concentration camp and then gassed. It's not the same thing.
Based on your ethnicity. And
exactly.
That's what we've seen too, the mask requirements and being calling that discrimination. Ammon Bundy was saying that this is discrimination, just like the racial segregation. So Ammon Bundy really brought this up about a year ago. But, you know, mask requirement, it's not based on race or ethnicity or your religion. So it's totally inappropriate to make those comparisons.
Yeah, I agree. We need to change topics here. Dawn, I know you spent a lot of time up in McCall and you've noticed some big changes in Ponderosa State Park. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so I actually had a couple of Boise Dev readers ask about this, and I happened to be up there over the weekend, and I was struck at the change. So if you've been to Ponderosa State Park anytime in the last few decades, you've probably enjoyed the tree canopy. Well, they've been working on a thinning project for about the last year or so, and a lot of trees are gone. And it makes you go, well, what's happening here? So we looked into it, and essentially they say that the approach in past decades was to just kind of let the forest grow and do their thing. And they are worried, forest managers are worried that fire could sweep through at such a catastrophic level that it could really just wipe the park out. The State Department of Parks and Recreation said that Ponderosa pines are actually naturally resistant to most fire. Now, obviously, a catastrophic fire would be different, but most fire, because of the way their branches are and their height and some other factors. So they have changed approach really in the last 25 years to thin out some of the non-native trees. And they really did. They took most of the grand fir trees that were in the area out, leaving the Ponderosa pines in place. There's a comparison photo in our story up at BoiseDev.com that shows them doing a similar restoration in 1996. And it's really stark. You see what looks in the before picture, like this very dense forest environment. And then afterwards, it looks more like kind of an open meadow with Ponderosa trees dotting it. So you can see some photos and learn a little bit more about this, but they're really just hoping to protect the park from major fire that could wipe out so much of what Idahoans love in that area.
We need to take another break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. And jumping back in with our reporter roundtable, Dawn Day with BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. As we were in a break, some news came over. I'm going to credit KTVB here because I got the news alert. The mayor of Victor, Idaho, and if you're wondering where Victor is, it is very close to the Wyoming border if you've ever been over to Jackson Hole. The mayor there has issued a mask mandate. It starts Monday, August 30th, for all inside public settings, including offices, retail stores, restaurants and bars, local government offices, and schools within the city of Victor. Now, this they'll have about 1,900 residents, but the Delta variant has really surged in that county, and the mayor there says it's the only way they can try to get this under control. So bears to see if we will see more of this happening. And it does not matter what your vaccine status is. With that said, Melissa, there are these new monoclonal antibody treatment centers that are being set up all around the state. Talk to us about that.
Yes, just yesterday, Governor Brad Little announced that the state is setting up three monoclonal antibody treatment centers, one in North Idaho, one in Treasure Valley, and one in Eastern Idaho. This is the same treatment that President Trump received last October when he was positive with coronavirus. And they have seen a lot of success with early intervention with COVID-19 infections. The idea is to create these outpatient treatment centers to keep people out of the hospitals and free up bed space. And so the highest priority is going to North Idaho, as we talked about earlier in the program. They're the hospital by Kootenai Health, and that system that's really at the breaking point right now. And so the centers aren't set up right now. They're in the process of doing that, and we'll continue to follow those centers being set up at Idaho Reports.
Scott, Idaho our legislature recently passed an initiative law. Then there was a lawsuit, and the Idaho Supreme Court just made a decision. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, this is one of those things where, boy, it's been a long week because this happened all the way back on Monday.
So long ago.
Seems like forever ago. But right, this was the initiative bill. The state legislature had restricted made it more difficult to get signatures to get an initiative on the ballot. So it required initiatives to get 6% of voters in every single legislative district. And Reclaim Idaho, which was successful in getting the Medicaid expansion initiative on the ballot and has a current education funding initiative that it's trying to get on the ballot, they sued. The Idaho State Supreme Court ruled in favor of Reclaim Idaho and declared that this law was unconstitutional and threw it out. And again, another strongly worded missive, the state Supreme Court said, ultimately, the effect of Senate Bill 1110 is to prevent a perceived yet unsubstantiated fear of the tyranny of the majority by replacing it with an actual tyranny of the minority. Basically saying and agreeing with the argument that you could have one legislative district that could have veto power over the entire state. You could have enough signatures in 34 districts, but if you can't get enough signatures in one district, that would put the kibosh on the whole thing. And so you would have, in essence, de facto tyranny of the minority. And so they threw it out and the law reverts to the law that was in place before, which is 6% in 18 legislative districts and 6% of all total voters, in the registered voters in the state.
I was going to say, and let's be clear. I mean, that was difficult to do before when it reverts back to what it was. I mean, just talk to the folks at Reclaim Idaho about how difficult it was to get the signatures and get this on the ballot.
Well, and I think too, one of the points was that there have been 2 out of 14 initiative efforts that have actually made it to the ballot. So 90% of the initiative efforts have failed to get onto the ballot. So that shows you how difficult that previous requirement was to begin with. If only 2 out of 14 could make it to the ballot, imagine how much more difficult it would be with the new law. So even with the reversal, it's still going to be difficult to get something on the ballot.
Yeah. So Don, some really good news for a particular Boise startup. They're going to be able to buy their product in Target stores soon.
Yeah. Now, in fact, Love Every, which is based in downtown Boise, they started up in 2016 and 2017. They offer a set of Montessori style play kits, primarily via subscription boxes to parents. They have inked a deal with Target to put a, for now, small selection of their toys into stores across the country. They're also available at Target.com. The funny thing here is they're not available in the Idaho stores.
Really?
just kind of a quirk of how this rolled out, but they are really available coast to coast. Target, as I think most people know, is one of the nation's largest general merchandise retailers. And what's interesting is they're not the first Boise startup to put products into Target stores. Boise-based Salt, which makes a line of a number of things, including menstrual cups, those are already available in Target stores and have been since 2018. So kind of an interesting thing for these local businesses that are making retail products to ink these deals with such a prominent retailer that we all know and call it Target and probably love.
So Eli is on my lap right now, as he usually is while I'm doing Idaho Matters. And no joke, he has a Love Every toy that he's playing with right now. He loves these toys. And I just love that we can support this local business in a new way now. They do such great work. They make such cool toys.
I think it's so great, Melissa. I mean, honestly, I wish this stuff had been around, you know, when my kiddos were that little. I want to thank all of you for coming on today. It has been an incredibly busy week. Thank you all three of you for the work that you do, that you continue to do. Our panel today, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman. Appreciate all of you. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too, Gemma.
And I want to thank all of you for joining us. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. And we want to welcome Tess Goodwin to the team. She is our brand new production assistant. Tess, my goodness, we are so happy to have you on board. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. And as always, if you have a question or a comment or an idea for the show, we would love to hear from you. Email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. I hope you have a good weekend. We'll see you back here next week.